You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us. Online also at kpcg.fm. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I think there's just a few more spots open at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, again, a little bit of space there in the inbox, comments at kpcg.fm. Get in while you can. Grant, you've got a write-up for us here from Breitbart. PBS Islamic lesson plan encourages students to identify with radical jihadists. That is a very provocative title. What's going on with this?
Yes, and the concern here is that it's not just teaching about a different way of life. It's more bordering on indoctrination. PBS produced this, and it's also fair to note that they don't have any sort of documentary about the Israelis' point of view. They just have the Palestinian point of view, and sort of it sounds like they're justifying Palestinians being terrorists, some of them, because they have less land and they're restricted in that area.
It's unbelievable. It's called the lesson plan is called Dying to Be a Martyr. Very clever title.
Yeah.
It's available free of cost to teachers and students at PBS Learning Media. And which, you know, it's interesting because that's one of the things that President Trump wanted to cut in the budget was some of the funding for these PBS and things. You know, and I think in fairness to PBS, they really have some wonderful programming sometimes. But they have some of this, too, which is very political. And it's public broadcasting. It's interesting when it's supposed to be publicly funded, and yet you're pushing a political point of view that many would not agree with.
Well, yeah, that would definitely fit in with the radical left agenda of siding with the Palestinians over the Israelis. Here, Mr. Trump has been so frequently accused of being anti-Semitic, and yet this PBS is putting out, and they're home to a lot of kind of leftist-leaning shows, they're putting out this sort of documentary or this lesson plan about Palestinians and trying to empathize with terrorists. So that would not seem very pro-Semitic either.
Yeah, and obviously it's being put out there for teachers, as it mentions, so they're trying to get this thinking into the classroom. I don't think it's a bad idea to look at both sides of the argument and present it if you can do it fairly, but this clearly doesn't appear to be both sides. It appears to be very much really a propaganda piece.
Right, and it's focusing specifically on a few instances of terrorists or bomb makers who gave the bomb to a terrorist who then killed dozens of people or something like that. And it's asking students to consider why this might have happened. Well, evil is why it happened. You know, a radical ideology that spurred them to martyr themselves because they do not care about this life. They want to enjoy the next life. They're not really confronting that. They're just trying to help us understand and hopefully be okay with what they've done. So it doesn't seem like the best program.
Yeah, it's interesting. So are they just looking at why these people would do it, or is there sort of a sympathetic leaning to, you know, like you say, maybe we should consider why they're doing it, as if there is any justification for that sort of activity?
Well, the questions it has is it asks students to identify how these terrorists view their lives and how they feel their lives differ from the Jews. So it's almost like asking students to put themselves in place of the terrorists. That's just a really dangerous path to go on, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially we already have enough problems with basically British American naturalized citizens identifying with ISIS. Yeah. So this doesn't seem like based off of the experiences of the last few years, it doesn't seem like that's necessarily a good way to go about it. And as well, I think there's no justification for terrorism at all, whether it's a just cause or not. If you resort to violence, and especially not just fighting against an oppressive tyrant, that people have done that throughout history, even that's how America was founded. But you can't draw comparisons to that kind of compassion towards killing innocent people, using your own children as shields, using your own people as cannon fodder. That's not an ethical thing to glorify or to find some kind of compassion for.
Well, and too, with a lot of that ideology, in asking students to consider it or to think about it, the ideology of some of the the terrorists, and we'll just leave it with that. Probably it goes deeper, but we'll just say the terrorists, is to destroy the other side, which would be these students that are learning about it. They're not just wanting to get along. They're wanting to destroy the other side. You know, Iran and others have said they want to destroy Israel. They've said they want to destroy America. So here you are. You're supposed to be sitting there looking at these other people and considering, like, well, huh, maybe they have a point. Their point is they want to kill you. There is. It's not like they just want some sort of peaceful, let's get together and get along. The ideology is to wipe out another group of people. There isn't clear right and wrong in that, and they're really muddying the waters with this type of thing.
Yes, and it really does strike me as something that has sort of stood out recently in media and various leftist groups as well. This idea that, oh, well, why are they attacking us? It's because we've gotten involved in all these foreign wars and we've taken their oil and things like that. I've heard those types of excuses constantly lately. No, it's we really should not have hardly any blame here in the situation. Obviously, we're in their area, and I'm sure no people would like another nation being in their area. But if they didn't have this unstoppable ideology, then these things wouldn't be happening at all. I mean, there are some people who have their minds poisoned. That's just the reality of it. There's a guy quoted on this lesson plan, and he says, "Martyrdom leads us to God. I don't want this life. When you become a martyr, your prize for carrying out the operation is going to heaven. We Palestinians prefer to die, just kill ourselves, rather than live this worthless life. Our lives are worthless. We are hollow bodies living a pointless life." So if that's what you believe, what is going to stop you? There, it's not like everyone in the world believes this same thing.
Yeah, I mean, does he say why he feels that way? Is he blaming the Israelis for that, or... I mean, because really, they probably do have a pretty bad life, but they need to look at their own government.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of funding that's been dumped in there, and, you know, it hasn't gone to help people very often. It's usually gone to fund terrorism.
Well, he does point at Israel and try to accuse them a little bit. He actually said Israelis enjoy their life. They go out at night. They have cafes and nightclubs. They travel all over the world. They go to America and Britain. We can't even leave Palestine. So there's the whole point of this idea that, well, the Palestinians are restricted, that it's not fair to them. A big reason for it is because Israel's taken the vast majority of the land that they should be allowed to have. So maybe we should understand why these terrorist acts are taking place.
Well, they're not allowed to leave Palestine. I don't know if that's true.
I was surprised to hear that. I don't know if that's true.
They are allowed to move around a little bit, but they do have to keep an eye on them because oftentimes they bring in a bomb. Mm-hmm. Or a knife attack or something. We've seen a lot of that.
Yeah, they're free to move unless they're red flagged because of some kind of past that they might be involved with Hamas or some kind of violence is connected to them. I mean, that's the only reason there's restrictions,
right?
Is because of Hamas. And I think, if I remember correctly, the Palestinians have per capita, they have one of the highest funded humanitarian efforts in the world. The amount of aid coming in from the U.S., European Union, all these other ones per person, but the money never reaches the people. It doesn't go towards schools and infrastructure and food and medicine. It goes towards Hamas's weapons, caches, and funding their terrorism because people don't want Hamas if they're doing well. Then, like, oh, what's the point of having Hamas if we're actually living fine? Then we don't need to fight the Israelis anymore because we're comfortable. But Hamas functions in poverty. If you keep the people poor, if you keep them living a terrible life, then they're going to want to fight someone. So that's how Hamas works. They deliberately impoverish their own people so they can keep recruiting soldiers for the war.
Yeah, PBS should do a lesson plan on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you grow up, I mean, I can understand if you're a young Palestinian, you grow up in a bad situation, and you're constantly told, well, it's somebody else's fault, Israel, America, whoever. You'd probably believe it, probably be pretty bitter. But that same teaching, which Hamas is teaching, is really the same teaching that they're giving here in this PBS thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking their point of view and saying, well, maybe you should consider this. And that's ridiculous. Because if you're a student and you have a teacher telling you all these things, there's not too many students, unless maybe they're hearing it from their parents or something, that would question much. You know, to say, We can't ever leave Palestine. You know, people say, oh, I can't believe that. Well, is that true, though? You know, that's where these lesson plans are pushed at people, and hopefully the students are smart enough to say, I'd counterpoint on that. I don't think that's true. I've looked into it, but a lot of times that doesn't happen.
And if that is true, that they're not allowed to leave Palestine, a big reason for that would be that the 14 other Arab nations there refuse to allow any of the Palestinians into their borders to live there because they're trying to put pressure on Israel by keeping all the Palestinians in that area. That's been widely known for a long time. It's been hidden by the media and a lot of mainstream sources now. But Arab nations are the reason the Palestinians can't go live anywhere else in the vast majority of the Middle East. They're all stuck in Israel.
Yeah. And also that argument that, well, you know, Israel's the Johnny-come-lately. Check your archaeology.
They've been there thousands of years ahead of everyone else.
But that's their land. It's yeah. Judah's land. So, but they don't like that archaeology. That's not a convenient part of their narrative. But we've got a great website on that and a great program, Watch Jerusalem, here. Brent Nottigal, where they go into a lot of that archaeology that proves that actually that land does belong to Judah, to Israel.
I saw a political cartoon where it shows an archaeologist, he's uncovering some kind of Jewish, it was one when they just found, I think, some scrolls or something a while ago, and he's like, wow, these are like 2,000 years old, and there's a couple Palestinians standing behind them, and the Palestinians say, wow, I can't believe it. The occupation is older than we realize.
Right. Right.
But that's how they think about it. When the word Palestine came from the Romans, and even a Palestinian state was invented in the 70s. 1970s, that's the first time you can find any mention of the Palestinians as their own people. So there's, if you look at history, there's not much, shouldn't be any argument about justification of why Israel should exist.
And it's this really strange sort of thinking, and it's pervasive on college campuses and so forth, where they lump in all these what they would consider oppressed groups. But if you look at everybody that's in that pot, so to speak, they would tear each other to pieces. They're not going to get along with each other. They're not all friends, but they just kind of throw them all in there, lump all the causes together. You know, the world's ending because of global warming and the Palestinians. It's all like the same. It's all in that same mix of stuff. And really confusing if you actually stop to look at what different groups believe. You'd find out they don't believe anything that's the same.
Yeah, and it is important to actually try to distinguish between some of the radical Muslims who believe what they do and then a lot of other groups. There's groups all around the world, various ethnic or racial or ideological groups around the world that have been brainwashed from birth to believe that all of their problems are someone else's fault. But you don't see any of those groups attacking and brutally murdering en masse in terrorist attacks like this. So there is an ideology at play here that makes the Palestinians, at least the radical ones, a lot different from all those other groups.
It's an interesting write-up. It's from Breitbart. PBS Islamic lesson plan encourages students to identify with radical jihadists. Yeah, I always wonder about things like that. If let's say one of those students actually like goes a little further than identifying, and they take it on and they do something, who's responsible for that? Aren't the instructors responsible for that? It seems like once those things happen, everyone throws their hands up and says, "Oh, we never knew it. We never knew what happened to these people." Well, you've been radicalizing them.
Yeah, and in that lesson plan, too, there is no instruction for any of the teachers showing these videos to denounce these types of beliefs. That they're just supposed to play it, keep quiet, and let the students see it as it is, and then form their own thoughts about it.
Yeah, it's amazing. But, yeah, I mean, if you keep going with that line of logic, if you want to call it that, what would stop the students from making their own videos that are against the teachers? Let's watch this. Right. Identify with me. I don't want to do homework anymore. I mean, where does it stop? You've got to have some sort of right and wrong and rules. Craziness. Abraham, you've got an interesting write-up here. This is from CBC News. You're always trying to get Canada involved. this is really cool. The Canadian researchers create first map of universe's dark matter. The elusive material makes up about 25% of our universe. And so they've mapped it out somehow based upon basically what it's doing. Like they can see how it's imposing itself, I guess.
Yeah, they use a pretty unique way on identifying it. Obviously, we can't see it through actually observing it directly. We We find it by observing it indirectly, how it affects other things. And the main way they can tell where it is in the universe is really fascinating. It's through it creates a lens because it bends light. So basically if you imagine Earth in some place and then a star away, the light makes a straight line to Earth so we can see it. That's how we see anything is through light.
Yep.
If the light passes through dark matter, it bends it and it kind of focuses it like a lens does. Where it bends the light and it has a focal point, which is Earth from our perspective. And this is based off of Einstein's theory of general relativity that basically it's a phenomenon. They don't really know why. But if you look at pictures from the Hubble telescope, it'll take a picture of the universe and there's distortions in the picture where the light's being bent by something. No, it's in a lens, like it's in the circular pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, where does this bending come from? There's no black holes there or anything like that. And they think it's from this dark matter, that if there's a high concentration of dark matter there that's holding together some kind of structure, the light goes through that, it gets bent, and then we see it on Earth. Yeah. So that's the main way they have designed this map, is based off of where the light's being bent.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's a related story to that from Wired.com, from the same research, I think. It says, a dark matter bridge holding galaxies together has been captured for the first time. You know, you always wonder that. You know, well, what keeps the planets in place, or what keeps things moving? And apparently it's this, from what they can tell anyway. Some sort of force, they call it dark matter, that's there, that we can't observe other than, like you say, the bending of light. But it's holding everything in place. This really is, I mean, it kind of blows your mind.
Yeah, I mean, because in school we learn that planets, it's the inertia and the gravity and all these different bodies exerting forces, pulling and pushing each other, that kind of keeps everything in the way it is. But science has proved that those forces they're incomplete in themselves to hold everything together. There has to be something else there, or else everything should spin off, planets should collide. The universe wouldn't be as structured if it wasn't for some kind of physical force that physics doesn't have a law for. And so this dark matter is that force where they know it's there because it's keeping things together,
mm-hmm.
but it's not something they can see. It's not something they can detect with any kind of math or anything like that.
And that leads to an interesting question, which I'm sure they're going to come to the answer. Where did the dark matter come from? Any theories? Anyone have any theories on that? Somebody put it up there?
Yeah, exactly. Well, if there's this dark matter out there that we can't detect, we have no idea what it really is besides knowing it's there, where did it come from? Why is it there? Is it part of some kind of physics forces that we just don't have on Earth and we don't understand, and we'll never will, because we can't see it or anything like that. It just makes people should wonder that maybe there are some forces out there beyond our physical detection. And if there's something that's not physical, then what is it? That's another question they should ask themselves, because if there's something that's beyond physical, it has to be something spiritual,
right?
You would think, or else what would it be?
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are people racking their brains right now trying to come up with a big theory for it. I mean, I'm sure they'll just tie it into their theory of evolution that has just kind of happened. But, and maybe there's already theories out there. I'm sure there are, but it is interesting. The more they look and the more they see, it does lead you back to some pretty obvious, or lead you to some obvious thoughts. Like, well, okay, but who made that? Like, who decided? And how come it works? How come it's not chaotic? You know, if you see things just sort of happen, they're usually chaotic to an extent. You know what I mean? Like if a tree dies and it falls over, it just hits a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like it doesn't usually perfectly fall in some sort of thing. We see that happen. But when you look at the universe and all the planets and everything, it's not chaotic. It all works.
Well, I think we should ask ourselves, too, if 25% of the universe at least is something we don't understand, we don't know what it is besides giving it a name, then if so, a quarter of the universe is that, at least the theory of evolution, the Big Bang theory, all those things, those are based on laws that we can observe from Earth, things that we understand because we see them around us on Earth and we can explain what they are. So if we don't understand a quarter of the universe, at least, it's probably much more than that, then why do we put so much credence in theories like evolution and Big Bang if they're trying to explain things they can't, they only can explain three quarters of? Is that, it just, there's obviously some kind of incomplete knowledge there. And if you're, the theories that were made of evolution and Big Bang were made on incomplete information. And so those should, by scientific standards, those should void the theories.
Right. And when they're presented, it's very rarely presented like, we don't know. It's always presented like, well, this is just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, we know all this, but that they don't know. And that's, it's always interesting because I was thinking, wow, you know, if you want to be sort of successful, maybe you should get into a field that nobody knows the answers to, and you just start kind of making things up because no one can really pin you down on it. You're like, well, I don't know. How do you expect me to know? But yet you're the expert in it. Yeah. So it seems like it goes that way sometimes.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And that's a big problem with science is that, I mean, science is a very noble field in a lot of ways, but when it becomes mixed with politics and with certain things that are want you to believe something, then the science loses its integrity because I think we've seen that in lots of different things.
Well, when you have a foregone conclusion that you want to come to,
yeah,
even though you can't support it, well, then all your research is going to be suspect, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, if you're getting millions of dollars from one lobby group or one political party to prove something, and the data doesn't match up, there's a lot of pressure there to change it, because all those people are supporting you and they want you to support them back. So I think that's a lot of pressure, but also just with science, there is that intellectual vanity too. And this is true with anyone. It's hard to admit that you're wrong or we don't know something. It's hard for humans to do that. And especially if, when you're the experts and you're the top in the world at in a certain field. But just from this basic report here, it's clear that no one knows anything about this sort of stuff or everything. There's so much we don't know that maybe some people could concede that maybe we are wrong or maybe we have an idea of what it is, but it's subject to being discussed or being revised.
CBC News, Canadian researchers create first map of universe's dark matter. And it's pretty interesting. You have one other note for us today. This is a write-up from that you did from thetrumpet.com. Putin resurrects Russian revisionism. It's a lot of R's.
Yeah.
Alliteration again. I love it.
You guys are the alliteration masters. if only you could have figured out a way to change the P in Putin.
That's true. That'll be my next tax.
What's the article about, Abraham?
So basically, this I think is interesting because it shows the kind of man Putin is. And that's this year, 2017, is the 100-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. In 1917, when basically Russia, that was ruled by the Tsars, was toppled, and the communists came to power. That's happened 100 years ago this year. And there's more to it than that, but that's basically what happened. That's what this event is going to be commemorated as. And in Russia, backtrack, in the West, we have a pretty good idea of how that story goes. Russia becomes communist. You have Lenin come in, promises freedom, promises releasing all the serfs, saying like, oh, we'll have some kind of utopia here in Russia. Instead, builds one of the most corrupt dynasties and regimes in history. Stalin takes over from Lenin, kills 150 million of his own people, starts the Cold War until it's defeated in the 1990s. That's the general narrative we have in the West, and I think that's a pretty accurate one when you look at all the atrocities committed by the communist regime since 1917. But in Russia, they view it differently, and especially with Putin, it's such a big event that he needs to commemorate it somehow. He himself was a product of that communist system, but he doesn't want to present it like it's a communist victory because he's not a communist today. A lot of his supporters are Christian conservatives. And so instead of spinning it like it's a triumph for communism, he spins it like it's a triumph for Russian imperialism. So basically that Russia is great because men like Stalin came up. They expanded Soviet power. They defied the United States. They made USSR strong in the world eyes. And so people like Stalin need to be praised and glorified, because that's the reason why Russia was great in the past, is because of men like Stalin. And so it's this imperial narrative that, that Putin's starting to put in the public education in Russia. And in the events around this October Revolution in 1917, he's going to commemorate it with that spin on it, that Stalin emerged as the greatest Russian of all time.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's in dealing with Russia over the years, from the U.S.'s perspective, or probably anybody's, it's really hard to get a straight answer out of them.
Yeah.
they have a lot of stories. And like, even, I mean, I was just reading like a book a while ago about the last days of Hitler. And, you know, there was a question of what happened to Hitler's body after he killed himself. And they could never get Russia to tell him the truth. Right. The best they can tell, Russia took the body and did whatever they did. I got rid of it, I think. But they would never admit it. They just wouldn't tell the truth about it. And it seems odd. I think they thought, well, maybe they were doing that because they wanted to keep the idea that he was alive out there or something. But even things like that where you're like, well, just tell the truth, man. Just tell us what happened. They could never get a straight answer. And it seems like anything that comes up, you just can't get a straight answer from the leadership there in Russia.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, there's just been generational changing of narratives, lying, revising history. And I think to be a Russian person living there must be frustrating, especially if you want to expose the evil past of some of these dictators. You're being silenced and oppressed by Putin's government. But then I think this shows the kind of man Putin is, to where he'll glorify Stalin in order to make his own regime justified. That's basically what he's doing. And that should kind of tell us the kind of person he is. If he's basically building his own empire in the image of Stalin, and he is one of the worst double crossers in history, betraying Churchill and Roosevelt to create the USSR, the Soviet Empire, and then just murdering millions of people, creating the Gulag camps that just were so indiscriminate. Probably, I mean, Stalin is probably the worst tyrant under Hitler, even though Stalin killed more people than Hitler did. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with. And if a man wants to glorify Stalin, it shows you how dangerous he is and how he's not going to ever make a deal with the United States or become some kind of ally. He'll always be an enemy, because he's even willing to rewrite history to justify himself.
Well, you know, you think about 150 million people being killed by Stalin. I mean, that's almost half the population of the U.S. We're like at 330 million or something. Can you imagine a leader in the West doing that and being kind of like revered, but at least half of the nation, or probably everybody in the nation, has some close relative that you were responsible for murdering? You know, can you imagine that? Like, how do you kind of justify that? They all must know their history personally. They must know, like, oh yeah, my family got killed by Stalin, and here we are singing his praises. Now, I don't know how they feel about that personally. I mean, what are you going to say? You're not going to say much publicly, maybe. But you would think it would be hard to accept that he was some great man when he's destroyed half your family or more.
Yeah, that's what makes Russia an odd case, because there are quite a few people who do like Stalin in Russia, despite that history. If they look at their family trees, there's big open spots because those people were murdered by the KGB and other people. But that's because under Stalin, he did give them food. The USSR was a great power in the eyes of the world, even though the Russian people sacrificed the most in a way they didn't have to, because of Stalin's basically going mad and killing people. So despite all the terrible hardships they went through, it, from their perspective, at least they were a great nation in the world. And I think they're willing to live under someone like that, because under a different forms of government, democracy has been a disaster in Russia. They were poorer under democracy than under communism at certain stages. It depends what part of history you look at. So I think for us, it seems unimaginable. Like, what in the world are they taught? Why would they even consider this, or not rise up against Putin and stop him from becoming another Stalin, basically? But I think the problem is, in these nations that have no history of democracy, no heritage of democracy or freedom, They'll look at the best thing they can in the past to find lessons from or inspiration from. And unfortunately, the Soviet Union was the strongest under Stalin. And so the reason Putin and other leaders, by hiding their violent deeds and kind of burying them in the past, it makes people kind of want to glorify them.
It's interesting. Well, we are out of time, so we can't continue the conversation. But that's an interesting point. You think USSR was the strongest under Stalin?
I think so.
You have a West that wouldn't fight him, and you have a Europe that's decimated. So there was no real threat. But if you're killing 150 million of your own people, I mean, what if a battle did come up? I mean, World War II did to some extent, but I mean, they were powerful, but at the same time, those other powers weren't either aggressive or even on the field.
Right.
So it's just interesting to think about.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you have some thoughts on that, but we don't have time. Sorry. Cut you off. Too bad.
Oh, that's fine.
You can read the rest of that at thetrumpet.com. Putin resurrects Russian revisionism. It was a teaser for a future episode. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau on Trumpet Radio Live, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.